This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 272 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, or Fort Washington, depending upon what week it is.
Close enough, right? Oh, hey, David, remember last time, last episode, we were talking about the Trisonica mini wind and weather sensor weighing 50 grams, and you said, well, that's 50 pennies?
Yes.
Well, I checked up on you.
Uh-oh.
And here's what I found. United States pennies minted after 1982 weigh 2.5 grams or 0.088 ounces. These pennies are 2.5% copper and 97.5% zinc. Before 1982, pennies weighed 3.11 grams or 0.11 ounces. So, the Trisonica mini wind and weather sensor weighs the same as
a quarter,
20 post-1982 pennies. So just, you know, for the record.
Okay. For some reason, somewhere along the line, someone told me a gram was a penny, but I guess I was wrong. But this is why you folks listen to this show, because you get this kind of knowledge that you can use at a bar for bets.
Yeah, maybe.
So, Max, should we talk about UAVs and get away from pennies?
Yes, let's do that.
Well, let's see. We've got FAA proposal news, which is kind of impressive considering the FAA is basically shuttered. We also have, from the city of Reno, a Nevada program. Drones for good. We haven't had a good story like that for a while. And night vision to track illegal sand mining. You know, I learned so much more about so much other stuff than drones by talking about drones. Japan set rules, but not for flying drones, but for underwater drones. And we've also got some NASA news and some feedback. So with that, I'm going to say, Max, should we get started?
Let's get started, David.
Well, Max, our first story comes from the FAA. We've got good news and we've got bad news. I guess our first sad news is your trip got canceled due to the government shutdown. So if you've got folks signed up for the FAA symposium with AUVSI in Baltimore, it today got not canceled, but postponed.
They say they'll reschedule it. It's hard to say when. It'll probably depend on how long the partial government shutdown lasts and how soon the FAA folks can get back to their jobs. So we'll just sit tight, wait and see, and hopefully it won't be too long.
And I'm kind of looking forward to it now because it didn't interfere with my Florida trip, and I'll get to hang out with you maybe if we get it psyched up. So, but let's talk about other things. Secretary Elaine Chao released a draft of a notice of proposed rulemaking, NPRM, we haven't had one of those in a while, that would let drones fly over people and at night without a waiver. So, progress?
Yes, absolutely. Now, like you say, David, this is a draft. It isn't issued yet. They say it will be issued soon. And it expands the activities currently permitted under Part 107. The night flying aspect is pretty simple. This would allow night flying for small UAS without a waiver or exemption under a couple of conditions. One is that drone operators engaged in night flying would be required to, quote, complete knowledge testing or training, including new subject matter areas related to operating at night. And the other is they would require the small UAS to have, quote, an anti-collision light illuminated and visible for at least 3 statute miles. I think those two things are reasonable.
Yeah. Don't know how easy it is to install a beacon on a drone, but and three statute miles is pretty reasonable for a standard beacon. The FAA stated that the reason why they're doing this is by far the FAA's most requested waiver is to fly at night, because technically now you can't. Now, the other part of this is to be able to fly over people. Allowed without a waiver or exemption under certain conditions, the FAA proposes 3 categories of permissible operations over people, with the original titles of Category 1, Category 2, and Category 3. Category 1, operators would be able to fly small unmanned aircraft weighing 0.55 pounds or less over people, including cargo.
So that's pretty simple, and that just means if the unmanned aircraft is small enough, under 0.55 pounds, you're good to go. Now, Category 2 is a little more complicated. This is for drones weighing more than 0.55 pounds, and there are a couple of requirements. One is that the manufacturer of the drone has to demonstrate that if the unmanned aircraft crashed into a person, that the resulting injury would be below a certain severity threshold. And then the manufacturer could employ any design they wanted to as long as it met that threshold.
And those requirements are in 3 parts. The small UAS must be designed upon impact with a person not to result in injury as severe as an injury that would result from a transfer of 11 foot-pounds of kinetic energy from a rigid object. So you're not going to get hit by a baseball bat?
That's right, yeah. Also, the unmanned aircraft would not have exposed rotating parts that could lacerate human skin.
That's going to be a challenge. That means you're going to start having to shroud your rotors. And C, no small UAS could be operated over people if it has an FAA-identified safety defect. For Category 2, a safety defect would be any material component or feature that presents more than a low probability of causing a casualty when operating over people. Pretty ambiguous for that standard.
Yeah, and that kind of characterization flows through a lot of these requirements. They're not dictating to manufacturers and operators, but primarily manufacturers, I guess, the designs that have to be employed, just for the most part, what effect they have to achieve. And then Category 3, that's for higher risk threshold drones, a higher threshold than Category 2. But it's also in three parts. And in this case, for Category 3, the energy transfer is 25 foot-pounds of kinetic energy, as opposed to the 11 foot-pounds for Category 2. It has the same Category 2 no human skin laceration provision. And also for Category 3, that there's no FAA-identified safety defect, but they say Category 3 is distinct, however, because the safety defect would be one that presents more than a low probability of causing a fatality when operating over people. You might recall in Category 2, it had a low probability of causing a fatality. In this case, it's more than a low probability.
And that makes sense, because Category 3 will be your heavy lift or your prosumer or professional UAS. Category 3 would have an operational requirement because of a higher injury threshold, meaning that you got to justify why you're flying over the people. I think that's pretty reasonable. And to manage the increased risk, Category 3 operators would include 3 operational limitations not applicable to the other categories of operations. Okay, what does that mean? First, the proposal would prohibit operations over any open air assembly of people. Second, the operations would have to be within or over a closed or restricted access site. Anyone within that site would have to be notified that a small unmanned aircraft may fly over them. And third, for operators not within or over a closed or restricted access site, the small unmanned aircraft may transit but not hover over people. It's kind of restrictive when you get to Category 3 of what you can do.
Again, what the FAA has done is stratified the risk based on, well, sort of on size, but mostly on the kinetic energy of a falling drone. And they're proposing increasingly stricter standards as that risk of injury goes up. So the NPRM, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, this works like others that we've seen in the past. First, it has to be published in the Federal Register, and the FAA says that should be soon, whatever soon means.
Once the government is back up and running.
Yeah. And then when it is published in the Federal Register, then that starts the clock on a 60-day open comment period. Now, we do have a link to the draft, which is 206 pages. I don't know how much it might change before it's published, if at all. But it does go into obviously a lot more detail than our quick summary here. So if you're interested in taking a closer look at the draft NPRM, you can find that link in our show notes.
What I've scanned of it so far is it's pretty straightforward. I can't imagine there'd be too many changes. I mean, they want it as a draft so that people can comment on it. So I think basically we're just waiting for it to get posted. But more FAA news. The state of Nevada unmanned aircraft system test site selected for Milestone Department of Transportation FAA UAS Traffic Management Pilot Program. And this is from the Reno office at reno.gov. So the Nevada UAS test site is awarded a new UAS UTM pilot program. God, I hate the word pilot program for a UAS test. But okay, so what are they piloting in this program, Max?
They're going to focus on urban drone operations. They call this the Smart Silver State Project, or the S3 Project. And they're going to use advanced airspace drone and sensor technology. And interestingly, the project here, like others, has partners. But interestingly, here a lot of partners, like over 20 partners. And some of these are Nevada-based companies. Some of them are from other U.S. states. And they even have some international partners. So they've got a big, big group here. This project is going to be demonstrated primarily in the city of Reno, but they're looking at some additional testing in other areas as well.
Well, I have to admit, the fact that the University of Wausau being part of it surprised me, but I guess in Reno, sometimes you got to gamble on the outside people.
Now, there
were... No comment on that pun, huh?
No.
That one just felt like a rock.
Moving on. There are two other test sites that were awarded projects. So a total of three were awarded projects. The other two are the Northern Plains UAS test site,
i.e. North Dakota,
and also the Virginia Tech Mid-Atlantic Aviation Partnership. I haven't seen any details of any significance on those two other projects that were awarded under the pilot program. Maybe it's just a little too soon for them to be reported in the press, but the Nevada site really got the lion's share of the press on this so far.
Congratulations, and boy, Max, the test sites still exist and still up and running. So for a while there, we were a little worried that they were drifting away to nothingness, but it seems like they've survived the dark times and have come out and starting to thrive. So WeTalkUAV.com has a story called Drones for Good, UAVs Help Survey Poorly Mapped Areas of Africa. So interesting story that we're basic mapping, but poorly mapped areas.
Right. And if you don't have maps, then GPS doesn't do you any good. And that's a problem for disaster relief agencies and local authorities. in Africa. So the task at hand is to get some mapping done.
And the start of this is in Tanzania and Zanzibar. It's a growing city, and there's a lot of new properties, etc. And they're going to try to catch up with the development. And officials can't keep up with basic services to be implemented. And that would be simple stuff that we're used to, which is sewage, water, and rubbish collection. So as these new housings and buildings are being developed, they're being monitored by UAS to track them and log them.
Now, they started a mapping initiative in 2016, and they have mapped about 900 square miles. And they're using SenseFly EBs to take high-resolution images flying autonomously. And, you know, they note in this article that in most of the world, you would tend to use satellites for this kind of mapping. But what they find here in certain tropical areas is frequent cloud cover, which, of course, is a problem for satellites. And also an alternative aircraft, well, it's just too expensive. So using drones for this kind of mapping is proving to be a real cost-effective and efficient way to go about it.
One of the things I was thinking about, we don't really talk about weather that much other than last week in our 20-cent weather station, but when they pointed out that using satellites in tropical areas having weather, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. And then they also said, well, and fixed-wing aircraft or helicopters, if you've got sporadic cloud cover, a UAS is kind of nice because it doesn't take that much to get set up. And say you have a window where suddenly you have like 20 minutes of good sky to fly in, you can launch the UAV in that time and get the results you need, where it would take 20 minutes to spool up a helicopter. And then by the time you get it airborne, the clouds are back.
And there's a quote in here from Zanzibar's Minister of Lands. And I think this really puts the task here in perspective. He says, we want to get to the stage where we can plot our hospitals on the map, where we can issue building safety certificates, where we can tell people where the local schools are. So, you know, we take a lot of things for granted here. This is really getting to the basics of it. So this is a great application for drones. This is a good story.
Drones for good. Yay. Illegal sand mining. No, this is not a Star Wars episode. Evidently, sand mining is illegal in India. And searching for gold in Indian riverbeds, in Indian being India, and the 8 months ago, they started flying a UAS to, I don't know, what's an illegal miner? It's not a poacher, but whoever's sand mining illegally.
Yeah, they ran a number of missions. They were operated by a private agency, but apparently they ran 46 UAV missions, and they had a little bit less than half a success rate, a 48% success rate. Success rate meaning identifying an illegal operation and arresting or fining the folks who are doing that. But they want to get that up. And part of the issue is that these illegal mining operations take place often at night. So they're going to look at fixed-wing drones with infrared for night surveillance. So that'll probably get that percent success rate up into some serious healthy numbers.
Even with the 48% rate, they're looking to broaden the envelope going forward. They'd like to do volumetric analysis of the pits being dug by illegal miners in the rivers. And you thought you'd trip me up with volumetric. Ha ha. And ready for this, folks? The ones they're going to be looking at is what else they're mining for, which is limestone, ignite, and bauxite leases. So basically, people who are mining for those and having their licenses, making sure their licenses are acceptable, that they are allowed to be mining for those minerals. Well, we took a deep dive talking about illegal sand mining, How about we take a deeper dive about unmanned submersible vehicles and Japanese regulations?
The Japanese government is concerned about an increasing use by commercial operators of underwater drones. What are they doing? They're inspecting offshore wind power plants. They're inspecting underwater pipelines, sometimes collecting seabed data. So while we normally think of drones being managed in the airspace, well, similar issues underwater.
Similar issues being things like collision avoidance. And this is something we don't normally think of, but how do you collect the drone when it's run out of power? You know, when we're always dealing with UASs, we're talking about, well, if it runs out of power, it's going to land somewhere and you just go find it, pick it up and collect it. Well, if it's lying on the surface of the bottom of the ocean, well, that seems to be a bit more of a challenge. And we really don't want lithium ion batteries all spread over the bottom of the ocean. The Transport and Tourism Ministry says the market for underwater drones was about 200 million in 2010, and they're going to see 1.2 billion in 2023. So clearly, Japan being a nautical heritage island and the seas are a big deal, underwater UASs is going to be a huge issue for them.
And they expect to issue these guidelines for underwater drones by fiscal 2020.
I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with. It's going to be an interesting, and then we have to wonder when the first drone ship collision occurs. So, in that water, you've been there, but those waters are pretty hectic. So it's not surprising that they want to get this locked down. From the bottom of the oceans to the stars. Okay, well, Titan. NASA wants to send a drone to Saturn's moon. This was from space.com. The proposed Dragonfly mission is to explore Saturn's moon Titan with basically a quadcopter.
It's one of the options that NASA is considering. They have some other projects in mind as well. So this may not get selected, but we have some interesting things going on here. Titan itself is very interesting in terms of the geology and what happens there. There's frozen ice. There's pools of methane, all kinds of things going on there. But they also find on Titan an atmosphere that's four times as dense as Earth. So when we look at, say, exploration on Mars with an atmosphere that doesn't really support aircraft, and so we have rovers that drive around the planet to investigate different areas of the planet. Well, with an atmosphere that thick, it makes it much more practical to explore different areas of, in this case, the moon Titan, by flying there. And so that's what this plan would involve. It's basically a quadcopter, rotors, electric motors. The batteries would be charged by a nuclear power source, not when the device is flying, but when it's on the surface of the moon conducting experiments and doing what it does. So since it has this ability to recharge the batteries with a nuclear power source, they say that if they go with this project, this thing could fly around that moon for years or maybe even decades.
Well, we know how well Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are doing with their nuclear-powered plants. So not surprising that NASA wants to go with that. A meme that popped up the other day, and I was thinking this when this story popped up, was that there are far more autonomous vehicles on the planets in the solar system than there are humans in the solar system. So, I mean, if you think about the four or five on Mars, and now we have one on the moon, and then we've got other quadcopters, it's kind of amazing what we're doing with autonomous vehicles.
Now, one of the big organizations on this project is Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. And they have a Dragonfly website that has lots and lots of videos, of course, animated videos and images of the Dragonfly, how it would work, what it looks like. And it's kind of a fascinating sight to look through. But it's fairly simple. The website is dragonfly.jhuapl.edu. And that stands for Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, jhuapl.edu. And, of course, we'll have that link in the show notes.
We got some feedback this week, Max. And this was from Dwayne. And he writes, are there any groups, vendors, or businesses to use drones in spray control of kudzu plant in southern states of the USA? Spraying drones would be a cheap alternative to reclaim the land and forests. And if you don't know, kudzu is a invasive species that is basically takes over everything and suffocates all of the other native plant life down south.
Yeah, even up here in Connecticut, I see a lot of it in some areas where you can start off with some woods and this stuff just grows over every tree and bush and shrub in the area, covers it, smothers it, ends up killing it. It's awfully destructive. I don't know if drones are being used specifically to spray herbicides on kudzu, but there is some interesting information over at the Ruprecht Law website about drone sprayers, their uses, laws and regulations, and some tips. And if you're interested in learning more about drone spraying, there's the ultimate guide over at that website. That's at jruprechtlaw.com/drone-sprayer. And you'll find there sprayer examples, sprayer economics, spraying law, drone sprayers for sale, some other information too. It offers a lot of interesting information on that topic.
And of course, thank you to Jonathan, a friend of the show. In the drone spraying law section, though, he does say, there are two most important things you know about Part 107 in relation to spraying drones. Part 107 is only for drones that weigh on takeoff less than 55 pounds and cannot carry hazardous materials on the drone. Now, these are not deal breakers, but you'll need an exemption from these regulations. So we're going to go back to doing the exemption process once you get your Type 107 certificate. But I'm sure Jonathan has some regulations, and I'm sure there's other people out there who would be involved with agricultural spraying, which we've covered in the past is a big deal in Japan. They've been using agricultural sprayers. So anybody in the agribusiness spraying with drones, let us know. We're interested. I would love to know what their process was for their 107 exemption.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap this episode up. We want to thank you for listening to episode 272 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find our website at theuavdigest.com. We've got show notes there for every episode. If you go there right now, you'll see the show notes for this episode up at the top. But if you're listening to this later and don't want to bother scrolling through, you can find the show notes directly at theuavdigest.com/272.
And of course, you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can become part of our Slack listener team, which of course was something we want you to do. And you can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And Max or I will send you a link to join the club. Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. We'd love for you to leave some feedback for us. You can send it to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And of course, you can find us on Twitter or Google Play or Stitcher.com or any other major podcatcher. And if you're there, leave some feedback so that people can find us going forward, as well as visit our website so you can see all the conferences and links coming up. Likewise, if you have a conference or a club that maybe you started We'd love for you to contact us. We'd love to help promote your event. And last but not least, you can buy some swag at our Cafe Press store. So with that, I'm going to say, this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.